This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steven Spielberg's new movie, Saving Private Ryan, has done its best to recreate the experience of fighting in World War II, and it has people thinking about the horror of battle. The history of war will be explored on a new documentary series called War and Civilization, which premieres Sunday evening on the Learning Channel. My guest is the series consultant, John Keegan. He's a military historian whose books include A History of Warfare and The Face of Battle. Keegan is also defense editor of the British paper The Daily Telegraph. Although he spent his life studying war, he's never fought in one. He had tuberculosis as a child, which left him sick from the ages of 13 to 22 and unable to walk without a cane. When I spoke with Keegan yesterday, he hadn't yet seen Saving Private Ryan, but was planning to see it today. I asked him how effective he thinks most war movies have been in conveying what it's like to experience battle.
I think they've done a very misleading job, indeed. And I think the one thing that it's that is obvious about observing a battle is that it's an individual observation. It's what the individual sees. There is no collective view of battle. There can't be. People are frightened. They're unable to, very often, to communicate with each other. They're in terror of their individual lives, and there is no collective viewpoint or vision. And I think it's very, very dangerous to generalize and to try and create a sort of landscape of battle, because the landscape isn't there for anybody to see at the time.
You've written a history of war. Has there always been war, or is there a period in history where you can say, this is where war begins?
Well, a greatly disputed question. I think this is an irresolvable point of view. Nobody knows. We don't have the evidence. But I like to think that probably in the days of small populations, before in the intermissions between the ice ages, the human being was not particularly aggressive. I think you can certainly say that sometime about 3000 BC, really when agriculture began, when people started to till the soil, people saw a real motive for aggression. And that's when war as we know it began, about 5,000 years ago.
What would you say are some of the biggest changes in how wars are fought since the time when you started studying the history of warfare?
When I began to study war, let's say in 1953, when I went to university, the Chinese Civil War had just ended. The French were deep in a colonial war in Indochina. There was the French-Algerian War just coming up, and the American War in Vietnam. These were very extraordinary wars in that they pitted trained Western-style armies against popular armies living in the community and fighting on their own homeland, in their own territory. They obsessed the news media in the years that they went on. We had 20 years, really, of people's warfare or popular warfare, and it was thought to be the war of the future. This is the way war was going to be. And since then, we have not, in fact, had any wars like that. And looking back, I think that is one of the greatest changes. And it changed for two reasons. One is that Western societies lost the will to fight those sort of wars, partly because they got defeated, as it happened in all of them, but partly also because they began to think they were immoral. But over time, the people on the ground, the successors, have themselves decided that they don't wish to fight wars like that again. People's war is, in a way, the most unbearable form of war there is, because you play time and life against technology. And the sufferings of a nation which decides to play time and life against technology are unspeakably awful. And friends of mine who go to Vietnam now, Vietnamese scholars, say that if you speak to young Vietnamese, they say, why did our parents' generation do it? We wouldn't do it. We would never have a war like that again. So looking back over over the time in which I've been studying war, I would say we, you know, the time of people's war came and went in my own lifetime. Very extraordinary.
Well, how much faith do you have in professional peacekeepers to help either keep the peace or enforce the laws of war?
I have very, very great faith because, curiously, they prevail for moral reasons. There is a sort of legitimacy, both a moral and a practical legitimacy about disciplined armies which know exactly what they want to do. I mean, after all, Saddam's invasion of Kuwait was an illegal act. The task force that went there, it was largely American in composition, knew exactly what it had to do, and it did it with extreme efficiency. In a way, that was an easy problem. The multinational force that has gone to Bosnia has a much more difficult task. It's got a much looser, much vaguer target. But it does know exactly what it wants to do, and it does have a moral dignity, whereas those on the other side don't have moral integrity because their hands are stained with blood, there's murder and atrocity in their records. In a way, they don't really know what they want either. They have no clear war aims. So I think that the peacekeepers, although they may irritate newspaper readers at home, television viewers at home, by the slowness with which they get on top of the problem, I think that through their own qualities, and as long as the governments at home continue to support them, they will overcome the disorders they're trying to deal with.
John Keegan is my guest. He's a military historian who's the author of such books as The Face of Battle and The History of Warfare. He's the consultant to the new Learning Channel series, War and Civilization, which premieres Sunday night. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with military historian John Keegan. He's the author of such books as The Face of Battle and The History of Warfare. He's the series consultant to the TV series War and Civilization, which begins Sunday night on the Learning Channel. You were born in London in 1934, and you grew up during World War II. What was your first exposure to the war?
I very well remember my younger sister, who's a year younger than I am, bursting into terrified tears when a barrage balloon appeared on the horizon. Barrage balloons were balloons that was tethered to the ground by a cable, which was supposed to cut the wing of a German bomber if it flew into it by mistake. And, of course, there were hundreds and hundreds of barrage balloons all over Britain during the war, around the big cities. This, though, I happen to know, was in 1938, it was practice. It must have been about the time of the Munich crisis. I also remember being evacuated for the Munich crisis. That's to say, taken out of London and sent down to the country because, as millions of British children were, because it was feared that the Munich crisis might become a war which would lead to the bombing of London. It did happen in 1939, in the following year. And I remember that too.
So your sister was terrified. What was your reaction?
I couldn't understand what on earth all the fuss was, but then I was just old enough to know what a barrage balloon was, and she wasn't. Curiously, like so many European school children European children outside areas of conflict, I had a very, very happy time during the war and went to live in the country. Found the little bits of war that I saw terribly exciting.
You were sent away to the countryside after World War II actually started?
Yes. Like millions and millions of English children. The cities were emptied of children and they were sent down to the countryside to be safe from the bombing. I think something like 4 to 5 million English children went to the country, and they all went in about a week at the beginning of September 1939. It was an extraordinary population movement.
And you took a train?
They were packed into trains with their school teachers and sent off to villages and small towns where people had been told that they were to accept so many children. The larger the house you had, the more children you had to accept. It was a very, very extraordinary bit of social engineering.
And where did you stay?
Curiously, my father was one of the officials in charge of all this movement. So we went down with him to the West Country, to Somerset, near Bath. Most Americans know where Bath is. And we spent 5 happy years in the country, far from the fighting.
But I think you did witness the massing of American troops in preparation for the Normandy invasion.
Absolutely. One of my strongest memories of the is of the GIs coming. Somerset is a very rural little county, and I think there were probably more Americans than English people in Somerset in the months before D-Day. The Americans became very, very popular, particularly with young people, because they were so light-hearted and outgoing in a way that the English weren't, and because they were very, very generous. We had had 4 years of war and living on very skimpy rations indeed, and the Americans, you didn't meet an American who didn't give you some chewing gum or offer you candy or something like that. All English school children of the war years remember those things about the Americans, which is why that generation and their equivalent American generation have such a strong feeling for each other, which alas is gone now, I think, because we simply don't have that same exposure. But it was a very interesting cultural exchange and a very creative one.
When you were a child and the war was being fought, were you confident that the Allies would win, or did you think that you'd eventually be invaded by Germany and live under German rule?
I think my parents were, like most English people, were particularly at the beginning of the war, very anxious indeed. We'd suffered such a terrible defeat in 1940. I think that there was real anxiety that Britain might not survive. I think this probably, unfortunately, is true of little boys everywhere. So fervently patriotic was I that I didn't accept for one moment that Britain could be defeated. I was absolutely certain that we were going to win, and so did all my friends at school. And we all felt the same way. Unfortunately, I think that little German boys probably felt the same.
Your father fought in World War I. Did you grow up hearing a lot of war stories about the First World War?
Only carefully censored ones. I think that's very common. I think fathers tell their children just as much as they think they ought to hear and know more. And my father was a gunner, artillery. I don't know whether he had a very dangerous war or not. He was gassed slightly in the spring of 1918. My father-in-law, also in the First World War, he was a fighter pilot in the Royal Naval Air Service. I think he was much luckier than my father to survive. And he would occasionally say something about his war service, but on the whole, I think grown-ups sheltered the young from what went on, and I think they still do shelter the young from what goes on. Although, of course, since the young see versions of war on television and video and cinema, there's not much point in trying to shelter them any longer.
What were the themes of the war stories your father and father-in-law would tell you?
My father really made the war out to be rather cosy. A lot of friendship, and he was very fond of the horses, because, of course, in those days, guns were pulled by horses. He made it out to be rather like a big picnic, really. And I think that's a common way in which veterans talk about the war to their children. They emphasize the nice bits and leave the nasty bits out.
What about when you were an adult? Did he still talk that way?
Once or twice towards the end of his life, from my aunt, he'd said one or two things. His two brothers went to the war as well. They all came back, curiously, but my father was the youngest, and when my grandmother, his mother, took him to the railroad station to send him off to France in 1917 as a boy soldier, really, he later told me that she said to him, "I will never see you again." I've always thought this the most extraordinary thing for a mother to say to her youngest son, sending him off to the war. But it wasn't heartlessness, of course, it was terror. And she did, in fact, she didn't see any of them again, because that winter, the winter of 1917, she succumbed to a winter illness and died. And my aunt told me she believed that she had worried herself to death, that having three sons on the Western Front just reduced her to a chronic state of panic. And when she got a sort of chest infection or something that winter, she just gave up the ghost and died. I'm perfectly prepared to believe it. I think the whole thing entirely credible. So I did, in a way, when I was older, learn something more about the family experience of the war.
Did you want to be able to experience war yourself, to fight in a war, after having grown up during World War II, having had a father who fought in World War I?
Having achieved the age of reason, I think not at all, absolutely not, and indeed, more and more as I grow older, I think the most, of course, as one grows older, one becomes less vigorous and vital and less physically self-confident, and of course much, much less imbued with a sense of one's own immortality, which I think the young have. But as I grow older, I come increasingly to think that being in a battle is really the most horrible thing that any human being could possibly undergo.
Well, John Keegan, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Keegan is a military historian and the consultant for the new documentary series War and Civilization. It premieres Sunday on the Learning Channel.